that gets a lot of notification as being the co-cheese state, we're a bunch of cheeseheads, actually has a greater percentage of its workforce in manufacturing than any other state in the Union, and that's to this very day.
When the ironworks in Bayview organized a union and they were asking to have union rights, the police came in on their horses and beat them down, and people were maimed and injured and died because of it. Well, that'll have to happen again, I guess.
In 1911, Wisconsin became kind of the birthplace of a lot of great social and worker legislation, namely workers' compensation. The first law in the country was passed here in Wisconsin in 1911, exactly 100 years ago. And of course, now we're seeing 100 years later, all that progress being decimated by the current state legislature and governor.
How stable is he that he cannot budge, that he wants to destroy all the unions in the state that public workers belong to? And that's quite a few people.
What's been happening has just been amazing. So many people, they take their one day off of work because they work three jobs, and they go to Madison and they protest. Or they stay in Milwaukee and they protest. It tells Scott Walker that they don't want this.
We go through life in a constant struggle. You're going to win some of these battles, you're going to lose some. And no right or benefit that you've won is there unless you continue to work for it. That's something that, you know, we have forgotten. A lot of us got a little fat and soft, and I think we've learned our lesson.
Madison, Wisconsin is again the center of a fight for labor and collective bargaining rights. We did most of these interviews last week, just as the news broke that collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin had been all but eliminated for public workers. This came after 3 weeks of massive protests in Madison and less publicized protests across the state that inspired social justice activists nationally and internationally. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we speak with Ken Germanson of the Wisconsin Labor History Society. We also have interviews with Margaret Shannon, Natalie Soros, and Laurel Sulfate, all of Wisconsin, all opposed to the union-busting budget repair bill proposed in the Wisconsin State Senate in February 2011. Stay tuned.
My name is Ken Germanson, and I'm former president of the Wisconsin Labor History Society and a retired labor union official, and I guess that's what you need to know. Wisconsin has a rich labor history, and it goes way back into the 1840s and into 1870 when, for instance, the nation's largest group of unions was actually headquartered here and founded here in something called the Knights of St. Crispin, which started out mainly in the shoe industry. And that was a short-lived group that was around for about 3 or 4 years when the recession of 1873 kind of knocked it out. But Wisconsin came to the forefront, you know, a bit later, around 1886. And that was when there was a strong eight-hour day movement throughout the whole nation. And spurred on by the Knights of Labor and a few others and the fledgling AFL at that time, they had a nationwide eight-hour day campaign. And they all pledged that by May 1st of 1886, we'd have an eight-hour day in this country. And there were rallies and lots of effort done in cities throughout the United States, and Milwaukee, Chicago, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Baltimore, and so forth, all had strong movements at that time. In Milwaukee, beginning on May 1st, they started a pretty general strike in the industrial plants that were already here. Wisconsin, while it gets a lot of notification as being the quote cheese state, and we're a bunch of cheeseheads, actually has a greater percentage of its workforce in manufacturing than any other state in the union, and that's to this very day. So there were factories here then. Most of the factories were shut down by May 1st by the workers walking out and by some of the employers actually closing the plants so that they wouldn't be too much trouble. But the biggest industry in town was the Bayview Rolling Mills, which was then employed about 1,700 people. They refused to shut down. So about 1,500 workers began massing the days of early May and marching towards that plant to shut them down. On May 4th, the governor, Jeremiah Rusk, ordered out the state militia at the behest of a local business people. And on May 5th, the marchers started towards the plant again. Now, of course, you got to recall these were mainly Polish workers because that particular side of town was primarily Polish. When they got there, the state militia was lined up in front of the plant on top of a hill and ordered them to stop, and they didn't stop, and the state militia fired into the crowd. And, of course, the crowd itself had no guns. They were not armed. And killed 7. So that was become kind of the Bayview Massacre of 1886, May 5th of 1886. And we still celebrate that each year around May 5th with a ceremony at the site of that massacre. And that set up, that broke the backs of the 8-hour day movement, that and the Haymarket event that happened one day earlier down in Chicago. But it spurred the working people on to form the Workers' Party here in Milwaukee and elsewhere throughout the country. The Socialist Party gained speed then and spurred on the creation of the Progressive Movement also here in Wisconsin. So out of the Progressive Movement in Wisconsin and the Socialists, in 1911, Wisconsin became kind of the birthplace of a lot of great social and worker legislation, namely workers' compensation. The first law in the country was passed here in Wisconsin in 1911, exactly 100 years ago. And, of course, now we're seeing 100 years later all that progress being decimated by the current state legislature and governor. So Wisconsin has a very historic labor tradition and a very, very, very innovative in that.
What about the collective bargaining? Did that also, I understand, Wisconsin was the first state to adopt collective bargaining?
That was for public employees. For private employees, of course, that was based on the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935 by the U.S. Congress and signed into law by President Roosevelt, but that excluded public employees everywhere. And on a state-by-state basis, of course, public workers tried to unionize and to become recognized. And that didn't happen until 1959, which is 52 years ago. And Wisconsin then became the first state to confer collective bargaining rights upon its public workers in the municipalities, the school boards, the cities, towns, and so forth, not the state employees. They got that right about 1965.
was the fact that Wisconsin is made up of so many immigrants from different parts of Europe, was that part of the strength of these unions and fraternal organizations? I mean, how significant is the cultural mix in Wisconsin to the history of labor?
Oh, I think it is critical. We have a workforce that, of course, has been made up in the Milwaukee area of mainly German, Polish, Italian workers, and the out-of-state in the northern west part of the state, you have a strong Finnish and Italian, Scandinavian influence. They tended to come from Europe with their socialist traditions, and they worked in the mines up there in the northern part of the state. And then the workers in the Milwaukee area and Racine and Kenosha and all that tended to come from Eastern Europe and German and Italian and Scandinavian. And, of course, later years, we've had a strong immigration from the south of African American, and so that now the city of Milwaukee, along with the Hispanic growth, Caucasians are in the minority in the city itself by a significant margin.
And how does that play into the labor history? I was talking to my mother, and she said in my grandpa's union, he was an electrical worker in a factory and president of his union at one time, and he had apparently broken the segregation of the union by allowing a black apprentice into the union. I'm wondering, in labor history in Wisconsin, how did that go down, the desegregation of unions?
Well, you know, labor unions have a checkered record when it comes to civil rights. But on the whole, I think it's been a positive influence. And in fact, most people throughout the country would, if you look at the history of the passage of the civil rights laws and the voting rights laws in 1964 and 65, they wouldn't have been done without the support of organized labor. But we had, in some of the trades, it was, and particularly trades like the electricians union, did balk early on, but that's been overcome. And what we found here is that the minorities have been the strongest supporters when we have organizing drives and so on. They're the strongest supporters of whatever union effort is going on. And in Wisconsin, the access to civil service jobs has, of course, it is made for a strong participation in the public employee workforce, particularly of African Americans.
Backing up just a little for listeners to learn more about some of the significant events in Wisconsin labor history, are there other events that you wanted to talk about, strikes, people's organizing movements that are really significant to the history of labor in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, one of the others is in 1898, there was Great Oshkosh Woodworkers' Strike. And, of course, besides making overalls, which they don't do anymore up there, they're all being shipped out. I mean, they're all made elsewhere. It was perhaps the nation's most productive millwork town. And if you know what millwork is, that's the frames and doors and stuff like that. In the 1890s, in the Midwest, they were the capital of that. They had a strike for 10 weeks during the summer of 1898, which ended with a partial victory. But then the chief industrialist in town, a guy by the name of George Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, George Payne organized his cohort of business people to charge the union leaders there with a conspiracy. In those days, the courts were still ruling occasionally that any time two or three workers would get together and talk about maybe trying to get some more money out of the boss for wages, it would be a conspiracy, and they would be stealing the property of the owner of that factory. And so, therefore, that was a conspiracy, and it could be enjoined by the courts and the union broken up for that. Well, they tried to convict three of the union leaders for conspiracy. They went on trial, and they brought in Clarence Darrow, the great attorney, the great defense attorney, to represent the union leaders. And it was a spectacular trial, and he had a three-day summation, if you can imagine, in that courthouse, and they were acquitted. So that was one of the key points also, because it again put the dagger into the heart of these business people who try to use conspiracy charges to stop union organizing. That was one of the others. During the 30s, we were one of the key states that really organized, and believe it or not, in the 1950s here, for instance, there was only one major manufacturing company that was not organized. And you would go down a block on our street in Milwaukee here, and virtually every house had a family member with a union card. So we've always been a strongly unionized state. It's, of course, less so now.
You are listening to an interview with Ken Jermanson here on Circle A Radio.
Going back to 1911 again, and that's when Governor Bob La Follette, he must be crying in his grave now, a Republican, but a progressive Republican, teamed up with some of the economists over at the University of Wisconsin and the labor movement to create the progressive legislation. The whole La Follette era here set off this whole progressive spirit that permeates the whole state. And we've had our drawbacks. We've had some not-so-progressive governors. But until this recent crowd came in, there was always a spirit of trying to work together, even though we had our differences, to resolve them. Not this turning back of the clock so dramatically.
Do you want to speak a little more to that with what just happened with the separation of that collective bargaining provision from the budget bill and the passage of that?
Well, basically what we have got historically through the years, and I was personally involved in a lot of this stuff as far as legislation goes way back, we always could count on a handful of Republicans to support labor issues in the state legislature. We were always able to, when we would have a Republican governor who was not particularly friendly, he, and they were always he's here, we haven't been fortunate enough to have a woman governor yet, always seemed to be not want to go quite so far. But the, of course, motivation brought on and by the arrogance that they got by all of the election victories they got last November, and the reasons for that are, of course, many. We think the people of the state are kind of fed up now with that polarization, and I think they're realizing that these Republicans who got in office mainly on the pledge of cutting taxes and that's all, maybe are going to be more costly to the welfare of the state than they originally thought. So we'll have to see where this all plays out.
Have you yourself been to Madison to take part in the protests?
No, actually I haven't, and it's not for lack of wanting to be there. I've been doing, almost on a daily basis, an e-newsletter that's been going out to supporters. And that's taken up my time. Plus, I'm still working, and I'm 81 years old, so I got a full plate. I'm doing work in the inner-city community right now. I've been doing it ever since I retired, and it's very fulfilling, and it's worth getting up in the morning. And I think you've got to keep your blood flowing to your brain, or else it dies, you know? And actually, surprisingly, Wisconsin's debt problems are not as great as most states. We are better off than the average. So this is unnecessary. This is strictly going after the unions and trying to make it more difficult for Democrats to win in this state. And since this is a fever that's going on throughout the country, to make it more difficult for Democrats to win in 2012. Wisconsin just happens, unfortunately, in this case, to be leading again, but in the wrong direction.
And then on the other hand, it seems like, you know, Wisconsin is leading in the right direction in the way of people all over the country and indeed all over the world watching this people's movement.
Well, that's true. And I've been putting out this every other day e-newsletter. I've gotten responses from New Zealand, from Germany, from two or three other countries, you know, plus all over the country. So, and, you know, people are flocking in to join the rallies. For the time being, as you can probably tell if you followed what just went on a couple of hours ago, it's all over but the shouting on this battle. But, you know, we will be working very strongly in trying to recall some of these guys. And in a year, you're able to try to recall the governor if you wish. That's a big job, a lot of signatures. They will be challenging the vote that was taken last night in the courts. And you can follow that, of course, on the news.
Right. So, but at this point, then, it just is going to the courts. And at this point, are they able to implement what they voted on then?
Yeah, unless the courts enjoin them. The courts are somewhat reluctant to interfere with a legislative process. So we'll see. But that's going to be one of the tries, and most laws take, it's something they can't do tomorrow. It'll take 90 days, you know, just by dint of the laws of the process of putting a law into effect. You can't do it tomorrow. There's a publication process and everything else they have to go through legally.
So I suppose a lot of what we're going to be watching then is how this reinvigoration of people standing up for their rights and joining together in solidarity, how that carries through to regaining some of these rights or getting rid of some of the people who are in office at this time.
Well, basically, you know, as I just got done writing to a friend who had written me, and I said, well, you know, we go through life in a constant struggle. You're going to win some of these battles, you're going to lose some. And no right or benefit that you've won is there unless you continue to work for it. That's something that, you know, we have forgotten. A lot of us got a little fat and soft, and I think we've learned our lesson.
That was Ken Germanson of the Wisconsin Labor History Society. You can reach him and learn more at www.wisconsinlaborhistory.org. Next up, we have Margaret Shannon, a retired school teacher.
First of all, I'm a lifetime member of the United Teaching Profession, and when I retired, I joined all three unions for the rest of my life because I realized that these unions have really helped to improve education. And they prevent it from getting any worse than it is right now. It seems to me that they're being anti-education, and that's how it strikes me, because he's gutted the financing of education by $800 million to the public schools, and not allowing the teachers to bargain on anything like wages and hours, only a little bit on wages, and then hours and working conditions. I see teachers being made to work many longer hours at the school and extending the school year and so on. And, of course, it impacts negatively on the pension fund. This pension fund was started, you know, way back in the early 1900s for teachers, and it's been taken care of by Republicans who supposedly are always much better than Democrats about funding things. So it's a very good pension. It's got billions of dollars in it. But now, by lowering the wages of teachers, all those who are presently employed, and taking away their benefits, they're going to be penniless if they have insurance. They won't have any extra money or anything. How much could they afford to put in their pension? They're going to have to use practically everything to live on.
So what do you think about all the protests that are happening in Madison?
Oh, it's great. I was up there just once. If they would need people to go, I told the union, call up all the retired people. They could get up there or have a bus and take them up there. And I think that would be good because many feel, as I do, that you cannot pounce on the teachers to pay off the debts, the big recession, and the debts that incurred because of the bankers.
How did you end up getting up to Madison for the protest you went to, and what was that like for you being there?
Well, I went with a couple of former colleagues, and it was an interesting experience, but it was on a day that their crowds were diminished because at that time Walker wasn't allowing anybody inside the Capitol. You could just be outside.
So, and it's pretty cold right now, isn't it?
No, well, they came on the coldest days. That's what surprised me. And one of the coldest days we had, and then on a cold and snowy day, they had like 50,000 people. So they had huge crowds. The most recent crowds have been farmers who are disgusted with the whole thing, too.
Have you ever seen anything like this happen in your career while you were teaching?
No, this is just unbelievable. I can't believe it's happening, that we would have someone destroying unions all over the place, because I can recall from my childhood that workers, once they were in a union, like my father was considered a really high-paid person because he was in a union shop. He was the president of the union, too, several years at his local steel mill that he was the electrician at. He was the first electrician to allow a black apprentice.
Okay, and then did that pave the way for more people to come into the union who were African American?
But I was the first one in that factory, and probably even in the city of Milwaukee. So that broke the barrier. And that young man was a very nice man. When my father's car broke down, his 38 Dodge, which was quite frequently it broke down, this guy would drive him home, which is quite courageous to come into an all-white area of the south side of Milwaukee, where racism was very much a part of the picture when I was growing up. My father, your grandpa, was also the president of the electrical workers union. So he was of his own company, which at the time was called Globe Speaking Tubes. I don't know why. I never bothered to ask it because, you know, when you're young, you don't think about asking sensible questions. And then there's no one to answer it later. And it became Globe Steel Tubes later. So he worked for Globe. When it was Globe Speaking Tubes, he was the president. Then he also joined this electrical workers union. And when I was a young teacher and he died, one of the parents of one of my students came and he said, when he saw me, he said, "This is your dad." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, he just didn't connect me, the teacher, to his friend in the union. He said he was a good man, he led us well, blah, 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 blah."
Well, that's cool. Mom said that Grandma was frequently worried about his job security due to his position in the union.
Yeah, yes, that's true. But the worst thing that his boss at the steel company ever did was the year they struck, they didn't get a turkey.
Well, I guess that's not so bad.
No, because they could afford now to buy their turkey. I can remember I got a new bike when I was in seventh grade, and the kid said to me, "Oh, you got a new bike. You must be rich." I said, "Well, yeah." "Oh, yeah, I know your father's just a factory worker." I said, "Well, yeah, he's an electrician in the factory. He makes $100 a week." "No way, nobody makes that kind of money." That $100 a week at that time was considered megabucks. And non-union factory workers didn't make anything near that. when I was a teacher, he still made a lot more than I did. And when he died, he was making about $6,000 more than I. So, and I didn't begrudge factory workers making that kind of money. Then we became unionized. We became unionized quite late. We were called the Teachers Association, and teachers were afraid maybe we shouldn't go union because they thought about, at that time, there was a movie about the dock workers, their union, whatever the name of, maybe it was the Teamsters, I don't remember. You know, how the crooked the unions were, and like we're going to join some horrible crooked organization run by the mafia or something. But teachers did join, and we became unionized. Immediately we saw an improvement in our wages and our hours. We got a duty-free lunch period, half hour long. We had to eat with the students prior to that. We never got a lunch break. So that was a big improvement in the hours. And then when they wanted us to come in at night, they couldn't demand that we did it anymore. We just did it if we felt like it, to come to PTA meetings and such. They used to demand that we be there. They could no longer demand. So I thought those were good perks for a teacher.
And around when did that happen, the Teachers
About
Association?
1964, I think, we became a union. And there were two separate salary scales, one for men, much higher, and the women's. And so the board made a, I remember it was $300 settlement, and they put us all on the same scale, the men's scale, and gave us $300 for all the years we were getting cheated out of pay.
That's great, and that was a victory for sure.
Yeah. So unions have done a lot, and I can remember there was after we had a strike in my school district, the board was trying to encourage us to get rid of our union, and some of the weak sister types thought it was a good idea. So they introduced this a teacher's association type thing. And my landlady, who was not known to be kind of a tightwad and really resented having to pay union dues and everything, said, "Look how bad it is with the union. What could it be without it?" And so everyone said, "Well, if Frieda says something like that, the union has to have some merit." So the union stayed.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are listening to Voices from Wisconsin, telling a people's view of the current struggle to hold on to workers' rights, and also about the struggle for the rights in the first place. We continue our interview with Margaret Shannon.
You know, my father was, your grandfather was a Republican, but in the La Follette tradition, a progressive. They were reformers. They made changes and they really endorsed labor, and what they did was the foundation for the union system.
Socialists in Milwaukee had made a big impact.
It was a very corrupt system, and then the socialists came in as reformers. And some of the things they did for the working poor, which happened to be me and my siblings, they had social centers set up, and you could go to those centers for your vaccinations, which my parents did take us there for those, and they didn't have to pay the money out of the pocket then. It was a great savings to them because the doctor charged $5 for a visit, and then who knows, I don't know how much they would have charged for a vaccination, but they would have charged something. And it would have taken maybe the whole year to pay off that little visit.
And in other areas, education and so on, did they make reforms?
Yes, well, they did. The Milwaukee Public Schools was, at one time was highly regarded as one of the best school districts in the state. So despite the poverty and where their location was, students had opportunities.
What do you think about the 14 Democrats?
Very courageous people. It surprised me because, as we know from Washington, most of the time they're so weak-kneed and cowardly. But these people, to be out there, they're not getting paid, and having to stay in the grungiest, cheapest motel over in the Chicago area, It's amazing that they're sticking together and they want him to concede on the bargaining issues.
You don't see that kind of spine very frequently in politicians.
And according to the governor, everyone's waffling, but every time they're on the Ed show, they say, no, we're still united, and no, we're not coming back until there's some movement made on this budget repair thing. Even if everyone would suddenly wake up, because so few people have so much money, that money is power, and that the political landscape may be changed forever, and our democracy is in death mode as we speak. A totalitarian government of any kind, whether it's the new Republican Party, what we call the corporatist, or whatever they're going to be calling themselves in the future, because that's what they're doing now, they're corporatizing. Another bad thing he did in this bill, he's privatizing the University of Wisconsin, Madison.
How can he do that?
I wonder how you can do that. I don't know how that can be done, but he's made a bill, part of his budget bill, and apparently he can do it. If you privatize it, doesn't somebody have to buy it? ...59% of our budget is spent on defense. Of that whole budget, 59% for everything related to war and the Pentagon and all that. 59%. Now they want to go to the second highest one. That's where Social Security and Medicare are in. That big 8%, that's got to be cut. Well, when they get half of the 59% cut, then come and bother Social Security and Medicare is the way I look at it.
Good point.
Well, they've cut in this budget, the EPA has been gutted big time, like $8 million, and they didn't get very much to begin with. I think they're 1% of the budget to begin with. I think there has been some movement. I had the news on while we were talking, and they said breaking news, so maybe something happened. And the Senate is holding an emergency session. Let's hope that the Democrats aren't with them.
Yeah.
They probably invented some other rotten thing to do.
That was Margaret Shannon, a retired school teacher. Next up, we speak with Natalie Soros.
I'm a UWM student, UW-Milwaukee. I'm an activist. I legal observe for the ACLU. If this bill passes, which maybe it has, maybe it hasn't, my partner will lose about $1,000 a month. We will lose our home because I don't have a job. Well, for one, I have a broken foot. And for two, the economy sucks. It makes me want to cry all the time.
Yeah, so this is not some ideological protest in your life.
This is personal. I mean, I've lived in Milwaukee other than 9 months when I lived in Portland, Oregon. I've lived in Milwaukee all my life. And ever since Scott Walker became county exec, he's tried to destroy the little people. He's tried to take away their bus lines. He does not like poor people. He doesn't know what suffering is. He doesn't know what it's like to go for a month without food, with having to buy a hamburger at McDonald's on the dollar menu because that's all you have. He doesn't know what it's like to go to a food bank. He has no clue.
So in this difficult moment where you've just watched the vote take place on TV, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about some of what's been inspiring to you.
It's been so inspiring. I've been trying to get my mother, and actually your mother, out there, because it's so inspiring. You can't begin to imagine what it's like. I've been talking to police officers who've been in tears because they were so happy to see the people. See the people out there saying, this is not what we want. And see it so peaceful. My partners even said, I've never thought I would see a day where I walked arm in arm with a police officer. Because we've been on such opposite sides for so long. But now we're on the same side. This whole state is united. It's united. The second day I was there, the union cops, even though they're exempt from the bill, the union cops stood there and told everybody that they are standing by their side. And they spent the night in the Capitol. They spent the night there in solidarity. The police saying, we are with you, Wisconsin. We are with you because you are with us. The police. It's just been remarkable. The firefighters, steel workers, every union. I talked to a firefighter from Chicago that came up to Madison on his day off to stand with his brothers and his sisters that fight for the union. Because they know that if we go down, this country's going down. This is where the union started. We're so going to fight. This isn't over. Scott Walker thinks he can dictate the state. He's not going to win. I mean, everything this bill proposes, it's all targeting low income. It's targeting seniors. He thinks they're all ripping off the taxpayer. But they're all paying taxes. It doesn't make any sense. And he's doing anything and everything he can. There was a 91-year-old woman in the state capitol in a wheelchair with a sign protesting Scott Walker. I've seen little 2-year-olds with signs being pulled in strollers. And I think that's part of what has kept it so peaceful is there's so many families. There's so many families. Old people, young people, different parts of the country. I've talked to people from California. I've talked to people from North Carolina. I've talked to people from New Jersey. They're coming from every part of the state. Actually, there are tractors coming in on Saturday. That's so Wisconsin. We are the little people. We're not rich, multi-millionaire corporate America. We are the little people. We have worked so hard to make it what it is. It's an amazing state. I mean, there's so many farms, there's so many factories, and Scott Walker doesn't want that. He wants rich people. He wants money. I've seen signs that say, I used to be a Republican, but because of you, Scott Walker, I've gone liberal. Don't take away our unions.
You're not union, although your partner is, and this would affect him in that way, but it's so much beyond unions.
It really is. It's Medicaid. He's trying to take away Medicaid from seniors and low income. He's just trying to do so much.
You are listening to an interview with Natalie Soros from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
The master's program at UWM was funding like 4 buses a day, every day, for like the first 2 weeks. And then they started running out of money. So then they just started doing it on weekends. There's unions that are running buses. Just about every nonprofit is running buses when they can afford it. But everybody's coming out. A Madison area technical college student has spent every single night in the Capitol that he could, you know, that they allowed him, except when he had to go to class and he went home to shower. He would sleep there every single night. He slept there for 2 weeks. I mean, people are so passionate about this.
Were you seeing a lot of youth out there?
Oh, my God, yeah. Young people, every walk of life, every race, every sexual orientation. Nobody wants this. I've seen massive movement of signatures about recalling Walker. You know, it's really woken people up. actually, when you called, I was on Facebook. There was a long stream of people saying, get to Madison now, because they're voting on this bill. I think this weekend it's going to be big, because I think people are going to say this is unconstitutional. What you just did is unconstitutional. It passed 18-1. But how you did it? No, you can't do it this way. I think it's going to get bigger. Teachers care about their students. They don't want to see their students suffer because of this, but they don't want to suffer either. So what do? Do you teach or do you strike? I am praying to God that this little stunt of his brings out the masses. I am very proud of Wisconsin. I'm very proud of us. I always knew we were good people, even though we have our faults. But I'm proud of how we came together. This state needs activists, people doing the good work and just taking care of each other. And that's what we're doing right now. And I think this is a very good start.
Natalie is among the tens of thousands of Wisconsinites to stand in opposition to Governor Scott Walker's budget bill.
My name is Laurel Sulfate, and I'm a blogger and an artist, and I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
What's been going on in your great state of Wisconsin?
Starting with about, I guess, going on 3 weeks ago now, when Scott Walker, our governor, first introduced his budget repair bill, there's been pretty much nonstop protesting around here, both in Madison and in Milwaukee and in a lot of other smaller cities all around Wisconsin. It has been very crazy. I mean, that, you know, nowadays, since everything is videoed, you know, you have access 24/7 to live feeds of the protesters outside and what's going on inside the Senate chambers and the House. And just watching the video, I feel like I can't believe this is my country. The budget repair bill, the original reason people were really angry about it was because of its plan to strip collective bargaining rights from public unions. But of course, that has grown into a lot of other things. When the 14 Democratic senators left the state to avoid having to vote on the bill because it was introduced in such a short period of time, it really gave everybody around here a real chance to take a look at the bill and see just exactly what was in it. And there were a lot of other things in it that were equally frightening to everybody around here. My particular focus since the protests have started has been on focusing on Badger Care, which is the kind of state insurance program that we have for people who don't have enough money or who don't have access to private insurance or employer-based insurance.
How have you been focusing on Badger Care, and why is that the particular area you're focused on?
I'm on Badger Care, first of all. My family is on Badger Care. Second of all, I'm a pretty vocal feminist activist, and I'm really interested in things particularly that I feel affect poor women or women in general, and I think that a lot of the provisions pertaining to Badger Care and Badger Care coverage, and specifically also Planned Parenthood funding and birth control and things like that, those are the issues that I really take to heart.
Who are you organizing with, and what has that looked like for you?
I've been working with Planned Parenthood, speaking out as a person who uses Badger Care and who uses Planned Parenthood services, as like an average woman who uses their services, and agreeing to take interviews and things so that people can talk to somebody who's just one of the many people who would be affected by these bills when they go into effect. I think everyone had a lot of confidence a couple days ago that Walker was actually going to sit down and negotiate. And obviously there were the leaked emails that came out that said, you know, well, we've got evidence that he actually wants to negotiate. And everyone thought, well, obviously that's the logical place this is going to go, because, you know, he can't just stonewall half of the senators forever. And then when what happened last night, I think everybody was really shocked. I know, as for me, I've already been glued to my computer screen, watching, just hitting refresh on my Facebook over and over, watching things progress. I haven't been able to think about anything else, and events of the past 2 days, like, haven't made it any better. Certainly, it's just gotten worse.
Thousands of people have gotten engaged in standing up for their rights in Wisconsin. So what's it like to be part of that movement?
It's frightening, and it's also very exciting. And I'm speaking, of course, for myself. I'm not speaking for any organization. I'm just speaking to the general vibe around here. But I think everyone feels like, in some ways, it's like a dam that was ready to burst. And now with this budget bill, and everything that's happened, the dam has burst, and it's almost as though this particular group of Republicans has just declared war on the middle class and the poor, and that now we've moved into a new state where, you know, before I think everybody deep down kind of felt like a lot of Republicans and conservatives were anti-poor or anti-middle class and basically only interested in, you know, in their own self-interest. And now I think we have proof is what everyone feels like around here. I hope at least that, you know, people are realizing that what's going on is a power grab. And that seems to be the case even with a lot of conservatives around here.
So there's more of an analysis as well that this is privatization and corporatizing, that it's not just affecting unions?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it's hard to know coming from Milwaukee and being here in the thick of it what the rest of the country is seeing and how much of the news is getting to other people. But for people here, it stopped being just about unions a long, long time ago, weeks ago. Everybody has realized because of the 14 senators leaving and the time it's given us to really go over all of Walker's proposals. Now, anytime he proposes anything, everyone says to themselves, well, what's really behind it? And there's tons of discussion, and there's tons of things in both of the bills that have nothing to do with unions and still have everything to do with what I perceive, at least, as being an attack on people who aren't rich, basically, the middle class and the poor.
Yeah, have you also been following, then, similar bills in other states?
Yes, actually, I just was reading about the Michigan bill today. That's particularly disturbing. Apparently, the governor is trying to put through a bill where they could send in a manager to a town that was considered in a state of financial emergency, and basically they would have the power to remove almost all power from the elected officials in that town. So it's a kind of weird financial version of martial law.
Yeah, it's super spooky. I think they've got their eyes on Detroit.
I think you're right. It's creepy. It is actually very creepy. And you've heard, I mean, there's lots of talk about how it being like something out of a sci-fi novel, you never thought it would happen here kind of thing. And Wisconsin has a really long progressive tradition, and Milwaukee is the blue-collar town. So I think that there's a lot of allegiance to the idea of like hardworking people and unions taking care of people, and, you know, that a union is people standing together. I mean, that's what the definition of union is.
Have you been up to Madison for some of the protests?
Yes. Actually, I'm from Madison originally, so it's a little bit easier for me to get there because I have a lot of resources already in Madison in place. I do have two little kids, so that makes it a little bit harder to find the time to go, but we have been to some of the big protests in Madison, and we've been to some protests here in Milwaukee as well, and the energy is just incredible. I know a lot of people remember when Bush was president and the war first started and there was 9/11 and there were so many protests, and I remember going to protests against the war, and it was nothing like this. The energy is so much more intense. People are really angry. People are really united. People are really happy to be standing out there together. The first Saturday of protesting, now it's been weeks, but the very first Saturday, I took my kids out and my partner, and we went to Madison for the protests. And I mean, it was incredible how many people there were, but the vibe was like a street festival, and there were protesters handing out hot dogs and like giving people just food and chatting with people. And the best part was I saw a bunch of cops standing around sharing hot dogs with the protesters. And I think that's one story that's been really amazing, is that the police really up to this point have really been supportive of the protesters. Even things that Walker has asked them to do or suggested that they do, or they really have it shooed people out of the Capitol when they were supposed to and things like that. And the police union has come out publicly as being on the side of the protesters. And it really actually shows to me like what people can do when they get together and they're not divided by ridiculous lines of like, we're the police and you're just the people, or, you know, things like that.
Seems like even last night when people went back into the Capitol, the police didn't try to stop them.
The police in Madison have been taking the line that they're there to keep the peace, and that's their job in this, and not to be enforcers and kick people out and cause panic. And so I think that they've been really, really attuned to the fact that they want to keep the protests peaceful. I think that their interest partially is in, you know, keeping people happy and safe, which is amazing considering, you know, how people have a particular perception of how police behave in protests, and often that's the case. You know, I mean, I don't know if you remember the protests in Seattle a couple of years back and the kind of enmity between the people who were protesting and the police, and there's been none of that in Madison. Everyone's been so peaceful and everybody's been so helpful to each other, and hearing huge crowds of people yell, thank you, thank you, thank you, every time somebody gets up and speaks. It's really great, actually. I've never considered myself so proud to be a Scani.
Is there something we haven't talked about that you really want to send out there to our listeners?
The main thing I hope people will take away from it is that the people who are out there protesting, first of all, they're not union thugs. I hate that term, and you see it used over and over again on a lot of the right-wing boards and things, and it's just people. If you go out there and you stand amongst everybody who's there, it's just all different people from all different walks of life getting together. It's so many people. And basically, that the people who are out there are protesting for you. They're not just protesting for their union rights, and they're not just protesting for their union or their little piece of the pie. They're out there protesting for the rights of all working people in the United States, because I think we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing if this goes through and this is successful and we don't fight it. So I feel like it's ground zero for something much bigger.
We'd like to thank all our guests, Margaret Shannon, Natalie Soros, Laurel Sulfate, and Ken Germanson of the Wisconsin Labor History Society. Again, their website is wisconsinlaborhistory.org. And thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesdays on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. If you missed any part of this program, you can listen to it archived at the KBOO website, kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. We can also be contacted on that page or at circlearadio@gmail.com. Our next show will air April 6th. Thanks for listening.